Oh, thanks for being here this morning. I'm excited about this class. It's one that was a lot of fun to write. I always enjoy the ones that are fun to write. That's not to say that some of them I don't enjoy and aren't fun to write, but some of them aren't fun to write. I don't enjoy. This one I enjoy, and it was fun to write because I love the book of Hosea. It's a wonderful book. We're talking about the fall of Israel. This is part two of the fall. I believe next week the final bell will sound and we will deal with the fall of Israel next week in actuality. But today it's the prophet's cry. And this was the warning that came out. And this week as I was getting ready for the lesson, I don't know how many of you have children who have been through that process of having to do some project at school where they ask for help. And Bill Cosby's pointed out, I believe, the system of justice in America. See, when I was in elementary school, I had to do a project. I had to build a model of the Alamo. So I sat dutifully and I watched while my dad did it and I turned it in. Then in return, I do that for my kids and they turn it in. So I do ultimately have to do the project. But not so with Rebecca. Our daughter Rebecca had a math presentation to make this week on the game of life. And it involved not only answering these questions about what do you want to do with your life, how much money would you make doing it, how much of that's paid in taxes, how much of it's paying off student loans, what's your car payment going to be, how much does it cost to replace the computer that broke, blah, 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 blah. But she had to do a PowerPoint presentation to go with it and wanted me to look at it. Now, you may not know this, but I tend to enjoy doing PowerPoint. Some might say I need to join a 12-step program for PowerPoint because I tend to do it too much, but I really enjoy it. So I got to look at Rebecca's PowerPoint, and I started tweaking it. Well, she didn't care too much for my tweaking. She said, Dad, I don't want you to tweak it. I'm going to do my own. And I said, yeah, but look at this one. She said, Dad, that makes it entertaining. I'm not supposed to make people laugh. This is math class. I'm supposed to be making a presentation. I said, yeah, but look at this one. And so she could do the game of life as Rebecca Lanier, or y'all can guess which one was her slide and which one was mine. She could put her job down as a marine biologist, which frankly, I didn't check her sources, but I have trouble believing a marine biologist makes $77,500 a year as the beginning marine biologist. But that was her slide. Make sure we have sound for mine. Or she did have a car with a car payment. Or but she turned in hers. It made me think, though, as I was thinking through the career choice and her choice and those of her classmates, made me think, you know, I'll tell you one job I don't know anybody who's ever really said they want, and that's the job of an Old Testament prophet. Don't do that one. Old Testament prophets had a really tough job. And I want to look at it in light of Hosea and what God called him to do, to follow in the footsteps that God had for him in his life plan. And if you think God has put you in a tough situation in your life for serving him, I suspect all of us can say, well, at least we got a better deal on it than Hosea did. Let's look at it and let's try to understand not just the story. And it's a familiar story, even if you're thinking, I don't know what Hosea is. Or if you're having trouble finding it in your Old Testament. Or if you're wondering, is that the one where the story will come to a lot of you as we talk about it. So we're going to dig a little deeper than the simple story and try and understand some of the niceties of the book of Hosea, especially as it bears on the fall of Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel. So if we throw up the map, last week we set out the context of the fall, and we noted that Israel is in a very precarious position in its world. We've got that northern and northeastern area of Assyria, which is the land between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, which has for 1,000 years plus produced superpowers in that area of the world. Then down south, the Nile with the Egyptian culture, also a superpower. And buried in the middle, you've got this area that's got Israel and Judah, the northern and the southern kingdoms. And it's buried in the middle because there's nothing really transiting in the desert, and the ocean transit, the Mediterranean Sea transit back then was so dangerous and precarious, they'd never even lose sight of land. And it was all very questionable as they would ship that way. So it was a difficult means of getting around the world. And the flow of traffic all seemed to go, trade and travel, through Israel. And secondarily through Judah on the coastal areas. That made Israel in a unique place in history, where in terms of civilization and culture, Israel had a choice. In that bottleneck, Israel could either be the influencer who influences all of the cultures and peoples and all of the nations and the superpowers that trade through and travel through the country. Israel could be the influencer of those foreign entities, or could be influenced by those foreign entities. It's a very precarious situation also because it's the natural place for either superpower to want to exercise control. And that means that either superpower, the northern or the southern, would control the trade routes, would control the army flow and the traffic flow. So Israel's in a very tough situation. The promised land gives Israel a chance to either be the controlling influence on the world or be controlled by the world. And that's one reason it was so critical that Israel follow God's will precisely, because it's the only way that country could have survived and been the blessing that God had hoped it would be for the nations. So if that's what we have, and that's where Israel was perched, the decision, we know, Israel's decision was not to be the influencer, but Israel sold itself for the foreign culture and the foreign gods. And lest we sit too harshly in judgment, it's not that hard to understand. Here you are, you've got your daddy's religion and your granddaddy's religion, and the religion of the old timers, or these superpower, really cool, hip Northeasterners or Southwesterners, depending upon which direction you're looking, with all of their newfangled gods and all of their newfangled talents, the real cutting edge culture, the smartest, the elitist, the most wonderful. I mean, hey. And Israel sold itself and said, you want to use us? That's great, because we want to use you. We like your gods. We like your wares. We like your goods and services. You pay us what you've got and you can have us. And Israel sells itself. That, in a nutshell, is the message of Hosea. Hosea is a message of Israel selling itself away from its covenant to God to what it thought would be a self-serving covenant of modernity. So let's look at this message of Israel, recognizing our message of Hosea about Israel, recognizing Israel's just right on the edge of the cliff. Israel's in a very precarious perch, and as we're going to see, Israel ultimately falls. I did not put a with that, but I could have, Rebecca. Yeah. God had warned Israel before this ever happened This wasn't Israel wakes up one day and just, stumbles off the edge of a cliff. God had given Israel plenty of warning. God had given Israel warning before they entered the promised land. In Deuteronomy, the warning's clear. You can either be a blessing to other nations, or you can decide to become like other nations, and God will destroy you. God warned Israel very clearly through the prophets, including Hosea. 2 Kings 17 set out, after the fall, what the prophet historian had to say. He said, this occurred. The fall occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord, their God. They had feared other gods. They had walked in the customs of the nations. See, they're doing the exact opposite of what God told them they had to do if they were going to survive. The Lord warned Israel by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I sent you. So they had the warning, but they didn't do it. They chose the option instead. They did not listen. They were stubborn. They despised his statutes. They despised his covenant. They burned their sons and their daughters as offerings, and they sold themselves to do evil. And that's what they did. And the warning is there, that the Lord was very angry with Israel, and he removed them out of his sight, and none was left but the tribe of Judah. That's what we have. So let's look at Hosea together. And I picked out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like 8 things in Hosea that I really would like to have time with you this morning. But I don't think we'll have time for 8. So your written lesson is more thorough than the oral lesson will be, because I do want to cover some of these in a decent measure of attention. So let's start with Hosea chapter 1. Verse 1, because, any of y'all ever take government in high school or political science in college? Okay, a bunch of you. Okay, this is really cool government and political science stuff. I love what happens here in this first verse. I also love reading commentaries on this, because a bunch of people in the commentaries, they say, well, this just makes no sense at all. And I'm thinking, well, it really seems to make pretty clear sense to a lot of other people and to me. So let's look at it together. Here it is. Hosea begins and puts himself in, puts the book into a reference, the prophetic word into a reference. This is the word of Yahweh that came to Hosea. He's the son of Beeri. It's in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, look at that. He has kings of Judah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and only one king of Israel. If we put our kings bookmark up, which you may have in your Bible, and if not, grab another one sometime, give these away, get people to come to class. But if we look at the kings, let's see who we're dealing with here. He's saying that Hosea is prophesying during the reigns of Uzziah and into the reign of Hezekiah from Judah. So from the southern kingdom, we've got Uzziah all the way to Hezekiah. In the northern kingdom, he only gives one king, Jeroboam the second. Well, Zechariah started reigning the same year as Jotham. And then you had Shalom and Menachem and Pekahiah and Pekah, all before you had Ahaz. Then you've even got Hoshea before Hezekiah takes the throne. Why doesn't he list all those others? The reason why, I suspect, is because Jeroboam the second, well, Zechariah, he hardly reigns at all. He's like a month on the throne. But Jeroboam the second is the end of this dynasty, with Zechariah included. The end of the family. Jehu had been anointed by God, or God had Elisha anoint Jehu as king of Israel. So this is an anointed dynasty. This is one that God had put out there, anointed. And after that, after the death really of Jeroboam, but certainly through the rest of those, all of those other guys, they're not really reigning as kings. Oh, they're kings. But what it really is anarchy. It's one guy assassinating another guy claiming to be king. If you go through the chronologies and look at the dates, Pekahiah and Pekah, and start parsing through these dates, it looks like Pekah claims to have reigned for 20 years. He's claiming that he's king way back earlier here while these guys are kings, which means that he was reigning over some little part of Israel. But Israel doesn't have a set-up king. They have guys claiming the throne, but none of them anointed by God or his prophets to be king. So they aren't valid kings, if you will. This is why in Hosea 8:4, I love this passage. They made kings, but not through me. This is the Lord speaking. They set up princes, but I knew it not. With their silver and gold, they made idols for their own destruction. Now, we've talked in this class about poetry and parallelism and the idea that you'd say the same thing again and again, but with a nuanced difference. Do you remember when we've discussed that with poetry? For those of you who are in here, this is poetic. That's happening here. I won't write on Stephen's thing, so we'll get a... Stephen, this is not your Bible. No, I don't want to do that. That would not be very nice. Look what happens here. Look at this poetic structure. This is worth noticing. They made kings. Okay? That's what they did. But they made those kings not through God. All right? What's the next parallel structure? They made princes. Princes are parallel to kings, right? Same thing, just younger. They set up princes, but God did not know. It was not from God. And then look at the last thing in this parallel structure. With silver and gold, what did they make? Idols. And instead of saying, not God, what does he say? For their own destruction. So here's the parallel structure that's being said here. You can make a king, you can make a prince, you can make an idol. But if it's not God making it, then it's made for destruction. Unless the Lord builds the house, Paul says, they labor in vain to build at all. Wood, hay, and stubble, Paul says, will burn up in the day of judgment. It's the prophet's theme. You can make your own king, but that doesn't make a king from God. You can make your own princes. You can make your own idols, but that doesn't make them God. It just means for destruction. So this is what Hosea is saying. Thank you, Steve. Okay. I might need it later. This is what Hosea is saying here. He starts this out. Oh, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, they were truly kings of Judah. But there weren't really, truly kings in Israel after Jeroboam. That was the end. So we get the tone here and the timing of this book and the timing of these prophecies set out in an incredible way in just this first verse. Y'all see that? Okay, that's one of eight. And we don't have, and it took me longer than my allotted 3 minutes. So we may not make it through many of the eight, but we're going to do what we can. Let's look now at Hosea's home life. Any of you ever had turmoil in your home life? Three, four of you? when the Lord first spoke through Hosea. So this would have been when Hosea was a young fellow, most likely. This would have been during the reign of Uzziah and Jeroboam. That's that early time period. In fact, these are the Indian summer days. Israel is at an all-time high. It's the golden age of Israel right before the death of winter. Jeroboam II, at that point, Assyria is weak, dealing with internal issues. Egypt is weak, dealing with internal issues. And Israel's thriving. It's the golden age. So in the midst of the golden age, when everything is coming up roses, God says to Hosea, go and marry a prostitute. Have children of whoredom. For the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer. Thank you, Larry Burgess and Dale Hearn, for the Gomer slides. He went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. The Lord said, call his name Jezreel, because in just a little while I'll punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I'll break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now, if you were in here or recall your classes, Jeroboam II, son of Joash II, son of Jehoahaz I, son of Jehu. Jehu became king and went to Jezreel and not just killed Jezebel, but killed the king of Israel, the king of Judah, and every living relative of them he could find. He left blood throughout the valley of Jezreel as he set up his dynasty. God gave him an anointed kingship, and he took it, and then he went much further than he ever should have and established his kingship in his own strength through bloodshed, rather than simply in the strength of the Lord. And so God's brought judgment back to Israel in Jezreel. And that's the reference here. So call his name, this first child, the son, Jezreel, because I'm going to punish the house of Jehu. The house of Jehu, the reigning king, everything's golden, everything's wonderful in Israel right now. I'm going to punish him because of the way they're living and because of what's going on, and the punishment will meet the crime that he had as the bloodletter and his fathers had as the bloodletters of Jezreel. So, prophecy one, that's first kid. If you have a kid, don't name him Jezreel. That name doesn't have good historical meaning anymore. Next kid, she conceived again and bore a daughter. Now, let's pause for a moment. Do you notice the subtle thing that Hosea is telling you here? He married a prostitute. First one, she bore him a son. And this time, she just bore a daughter. Probably wasn't his kid. That's the subtle message. She bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, so they're still together. He gets to name the kid. Call her name No Mercy, Lo-Ruhama. If I had had time and had not thought it sacrilegious, and this is coming from the guy who played Mick Jagger in class, but I'd have had Lo-Ruhama. Anyway, if you're young enough to know that, that was her name. It was Lo-Ruhama. Though I'm sure that's not what Lady Gaga is singing there, but it sort of sounds like it to my old ears. Lo-Ruhama. Lo-Ruhama. Lo in Hebrew means, that's not la, that would be Spanish. Lo in Hebrew, lo means not, no, all right? So, No-Ruhama, no mercy. Call her name, No Mercy. Because I will not have mercy on the house of Israel and forgive them at all. I will have mercy on Judah. I'll save Judah, but not Israel. No more mercy on Israel. So you have a child and you name him No Mercy. What about the third child? Well, when she'd weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. Again, not his child. And the Lord said, call his name Lo-Ami. Lo, not, Ami, my people. Call his name not my people, because you're not my people and I'm not your God. Here's what he's saying. Hosea, you're going to live a life of prophecy. You will attest to your prophetic message by how you live. I want you to go marry a prostitute because the country has become a prostitute. They sold themselves. They sold themselves. And the kids you have, the offspring, are the message I have for their mother. No more mercy. Bloodletting of Jezreel. Not my people. That's the message I have. Now, this is a harsh judgment coming, but it's coming against very harsh actions. These are people who burn their children in sacrifice. And yet, even in the midst of the harsh judgment, we'll see throughout the book of Hosea promise of redemption. Yet, the number of the children of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. In the place where it was said, "You are not my people." That's the name of that third kid. Lo Ami. In the place where it said, "You are not my people," it shall be said to them, "They are children of the living God." And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they'll go up from the land. For great will be the day of Jezreel. They're probably Jezreel meaning the meaning of the word, which is the day of sowing, the day the seed goes out. Great will be the harvest as they gather together under one king. So even though he's just said, name your kids, not my people, name your kids, no mercy. It says, say to your brothers, you are my people. Say to your sisters, you have received mercy. Then he starts right back in with the harsh judgment. This is a process in Hebrew that we've talked about, pretty common, called the chiasmus or a chiasm. Remember when something gets more focused and then comes back? And so you have an idea of judgment, and then you have an idea of restoration, and then he goes right back into judgment again. And when the writing is done that way, if you were in the class, do you remember what the emphasis is for the Hebrew writer? It's the middle part. It's written that way to emphasize the middle. Hebrew is written very differently than like a newspaper article where they'll teach you, don't bury your lead, you know, put the most important thing at the front and at the bottom. In Hebrew, they would write oftentimes where the front and bottom echo each other, but that center is what's the emphasis. Everything points toward the center. And here, the center is the restoration. And this is what we have. And that is the point. And so the point becomes, in Hosea chapter 2, with restoration, that the people will have a restore. Did you know this passage is quoted in the New Testament? If you have not read ahead, did you know this passage is quoted in the New Testament? Look at what Paul has to say in Romans chapter 9. This is Romans 9. We're starting with verse 25. Us, whom God has called, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people. Her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. In the very place where it said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. Paul is saying that we Gentiles who are joining in with the Jews in the church are a type of fulfillment of Hosea's prophecy that there will come a time where God will show mercy, where God will show his forgiveness, where God will show, as he said in Hosea, the children of Judah, those are the children of covenant. And the children of Israel, those Paul is saying in essence are the Gentiles. Those are the ones who are outside of covenant, not living with any regard for God at all. They'll be gathered together. They'll appoint for themselves one head. They shall go up from the land. Great will be the day of Jezreel. And on that day, God will say, you are my people and you have received mercy. So this probably has a couple of levels of interpretation and application. It's also, once Israel is invaded, a lot of the Israelites will go down to Judah to live, and they'll be reunited there as well. But Paul claims it in the New Testament, not just Paul. Peter says the same thing. Peter says in 1 Peter 2, you're a chosen, let's see, get up there, there it is. You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, lo ami, third child of Gomer, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, lo ruhama, but now you have received mercy. Hosea is quoted over and over and over in the New Testament because it's such a wonderful image of God's restoration. You see, what happens to Hosea in his home life and the crisis there is he has these children, at least two of which he doesn't know whether they're his or not. He has these children, and his wife continues to be unfaithful. Oh, his wife goes out and look what she does, just as Israel did with God. She says, verse 5, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. These are the commodities Israel's trading for from Assyria and from others. I'm going to go after them. They've got all the goodies. Just like a prostitute who says, hey, I'm going to go after my client who's plying me with all of these wonderful little treats. And God says, so I'll hedge up her way with thorns. I'm going to build a wall against her so she can't find her paths. I'm not going to tolerate this, he says. She'll pursue her lovers, but she won't overtake them. She'll seek them, but not find them. Then she'll say, well, I might as well go back to my husband. He was better off. And look at verse 8, which moves you to tears. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain. She didn't know it was I who gave her the wine, the oil, and lavish silver and gold, which she then used for bail. Not like getting out of jail bail, like idle bail. God's saying, Israel, I put you there. I put you in the perch you're in. I called it the promised land because I promised it to you as a land flowing with milk and honey. You had all the milk and all the honey, not just within Israel. You're the nexus. You're the bottleneck. Everything's got to go through you. Don't think you're getting all of these goodies from the nations because the nations are taking care of you. It's because I'm taking care of you and I put you there. You have the blessings in your life, Israel, because of me, not because of them. They are merely the conduit I'm using to bless you. So why don't you worship and honor me and quit chasing after them? They really don't care for you. You're a tool to them. And that's the message. Well, Hosea's wife doesn't get the message either. And she goes back out and she continues to do what she'd been doing. And Hosea gets called upon by God to do something new. Chapter 3, entitled Hosea Redeems His Life by the ESV Study Bible. And the Lord said to me, go again and love a woman who's loved by another man, an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel. Though they turn to other gods, they love cakes of raisins. So, Hosea says, I bought her for 15 shekels of silver, a homer, and some barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. Don't play the whore, belong to another man, and I also will be to you. This is the love of God, too. God continues to speak through Hosea's life. And God goes to Hosea and says, now you got to buy her back. Go pay for the prostitute all over again. Because that's what God's going to do for his people. God is going to take his people and buy them back. I want to get to that, but I think we have time for one other insertion real quick. And the lawyer in me says we need to insert chapter 4. Because it's a lawsuit. The Hebrew word for a lawsuit is used over and over and over in this. It's just the translators don't want to be too tort happy, so they didn't, they didn't put it in there. It's a lawsuit. I'll show you the word. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy. Hebrew riv. It's a lawsuit. The Lord has a lawsuit with the people living in Israel. He has a lawsuit. He's suing them. He has a lawsuit because there's no faithfulness, there's no steadfast love, there's no knowledge of God. Instead, they're swearing, lying, murder, stealing, committing adultery, breaking all bounds, bloodshed, following bloodshed. Then look at this. He says, let no one contend, let none accuse, for with you is my contention, my lawsuit. O priest, you stumble by day. The prophet will stumble with you by night. I'll destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because, not because it's not available, but because you've rejected it. You've rejected knowledge. So I reject you. They weren't, oh, I wonder what we should be doing. This is profound, by the way. You read Hosea, people who want to late date the Old Testament. Hosea is written very clearly in 8th century style, 8th century language. There's not a hint of a word from post-exilic Hebrew in there. It is written so clearly in early Hebrew. In fact, it's difficult to understand, too. It's one of the toughest books of the Bible to translate, that and Job in the Old Testament. But they had the Ten Commandments at that time. The Ten Commandments weren't made up later. You read through Hosea, you'll find him quoting from Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. He had Old Testament knowledge. They had Old Testament scriptures at that point. He had the Ten Commandments. Look at them. Number one, no other gods. He says, you worship in other gods. Commandment number two, no graven images. You've got graven images. Commandment number three, don't take God's name in vain. You take it in vain. Commandment number four, keep the Sabbath. They don't know God. They don't know his creation. They certainly don't know the Sabbath to keep it. Commandment number five, honor your father and mother. They're joining with their parents in sin rather than bringing them honor. This is all in chapter 4. Chapter 4, do not kill. He says in 4 verse 2, you're murderers. Do not commit adultery. He says you're adulterers. Do not steal. He says you're thieves. Do not bear false witness. He says you're liars. Don't covet. He says you're breaking all bounds. You're taking everything. You're doing it with bloodshed. He lays out the Ten Commandments in Hosea chapter 4 and says, I have a lawsuit against you because you're breaking these. You are totally, totally out of control. This isn't just, oh, gee, I messed up. You're gone. He wins the lawsuit. Because they didn't live up to their covenant. They didn't even try. It's one thing to say, oh, I made a mistake. It's another thing altogether not to even try, not to even care, and reject any knowledge. Oh, God had warned Israel. And not only had God warned Israel, but Assyria's encroachment had already started. We read that in the book of not just Hosea, but we'll also read it in Isaiah. See, at first, Tiglath-Pileser came down and he took over the northern part of Israel. All he really left was Ephraim. He set up three, and this is kind of cool. How many of you do BSF or did BSF for Isaiah? Okay, remember when you did Isaiah last? Whenever term, whatever you call them. Okay, Isaiah makes the same reference. What happened is Tiglath-Pileser comes down and Tiglath-Pileser, we'll see this more next week, starts dividing up the countries and puts them into his own provinces, his own divisions. Three of them were Dor, Megiddo, and Gilead. Those were the words used by Tiglath-Pileser. Isaiah calls them something different. In former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. And then he goes on to say, but in latter time, he's made glorious the way of the sea, that's Dor, first province. Second province, the land beyond the Jordan, that's Gilead on the other side of the Jordan. Third province, Galilee of the nations, that's Megiddo, that's Galilee. And so Isaiah actually is talking about this. We'll go into more detail later. That's a freebie. Let's move on. Now, ultimately, God offers his redemption and promises his redemption. But if we go to Hosea chapter 11, we see what God does and the way he does it. God says and moves out of love. Ties in perfectly with what Pastor David was preaching about this morning. Out of God's love, he's going to move to redeem. He's going to move to restore. This is not a time of vanquishment that never ends. There is restoration with God. And so one of the key chapters that expresses his love is 11, Hosea 11. What I'm going to do for you in Hosea 11 is give you, instead of reading it on here, I want you to listen to the way Joel Chernoff of Lamb sings a little bit of this, because he gets some of the mood in his music. And so I've pulled this. This is Hosea 11, 1.
From Egypt I did call him to be my son. For it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. And I picked him up. Yet they did not know that it was I who loved thee. With tender cords of love I did lead thee. For I was to thee as one who lifts a yoke, and bending down I lovingly fed him. To bid I bow to la 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 la.
Pause it there. When Israel was young, I loved him. From Egypt, I called him to be my son. It was I who taught him to walk. It's I who picked him up in their arms. And they did not know it. With tender cords of love, I led them. I was to them as one who lifts a heavy burden off of them. Bending down, I lovingly fed them. And they sold me out and chased after others. But my love abides. Now, here's your quiz if you haven't read ahead. When Israel was young, I loved him. From Egypt, I did call him to be my son. That love of God expressed in chapter 11 is pulled into the New Testament. You remember? Matthew says this is talking about, this is why God sent Joseph and Mary and Jesus to Egypt, so that God could pull them out of Egypt. Because the greatest expression that God's love would ever have is when from Egypt I did call him to be my son. Even Israel coming out in their disobedience were a type, a prophecy, a figure of Jesus coming out of Egypt. Because Jesus coming out of Egypt expresses God's love, not imperfectly, but perfectly. Jesus coming out of Egypt becomes the perfect incarnation of God, who does not disobey, but keeps the law and does it right. And in spite of the temptations, is not influenced by Satan or the world, but becomes the influencer, yea, the deliverer, the ultimate restoration, the ultimate redeemer, the ultimate buyback of humanity who has chased after other gods. Unfortunately for Hosea, he had to go through that whole life just to show that. But what a life he lived. While it was difficult, no doubt, and while it had heartache beyond understanding, go through your lesson and see how many times the New Testament, Jesus, quotes from Hosea. It will amaze you. It will amaze you, because God spoke through him in ways that affirmed not just them in the New Testament times, but us through the ages. Points for home. They would not listen. God had the word out there. God told them. God made it clear to them. God said it unequivocally. But they were too stubborn to listen. They were too stubborn, King says. We know better. We know our own way. And as I was writing this, what kept echoing in my brain was St. John writing to the seven churches of Asia. The seven prophetic words from Jesus in the Revelation. And those seven letters to the seven churches, every one of them ends with this statement. Let him who has ears to hear, hear what the Spirit's saying to the church. Oh, Lord, please, I do not want to be stubborn. I want to hear. I don't just want to hear. I want to hear. I don't just want to see. I want to see. I want to perceive. I want to walk that tightrope by the Spirit of God's guidance, by the power of God, so that I am in His will doing what He wants done. That's where we need to be. And when we stumble and when we fall, that's where we need to get up from. And that's what we need to keep going for. God does not expect perfection. God expects your heart. And He'll make you perfect. Second point. I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice. The knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. It's 1 Samuel 15. To obey is better than sacrifice. Knowledge, the Hebrew word for knowledge, same with the Greek word for knowledge, it intones an intimate relationship. It's the word used with Adam and Eve for procreating their offspring. Adam knew Eve, and she bore a child. It conveys much more than head knowledge. It's an intimate relationship. God wants us in an intimate relationship with Him, not merely going through formalities so we can check them off a list and say, we did our God thing today. He's got to be happy with us. We did what He said. He wants steadfast love. That's Dale Hearn's class on, who was it? Ruth. Chesed. Steadfast love. Wants steadfast love. He wants a covenant loyalty. He wants a commitment from us to grow with Him. I want to know God better. That's my take home. Look, I know Becky. I've known Becky since she was a child. She was very immature when we first met. That didn't come out right. She was a child. She was in ninth grade when I met her. I did tell her in 10th grade that a teacher and I were real proud of her because we felt like she'd really grown up and matured that year. So there was purpose behind that joke that I'll be paying for the next few days. But I want to tell you something. I know who she is. I know her very well. I've known her for almost all of my life. But I want to know her better. I still want to know her better. I love her with everything that's in me, and I want to know her better. I know my kids, but I want to know them better. I want to know what makes them think. I want to know what makes them tick. I want to know what makes them happy. I want to know what makes them sad. I want to know what's going on in their world. I want to know them better. Yeah, I know God. Jesus came so that we might know Him, John 14. But I want to know Him better. And the only way that's going to come is spending time with Him. Last point. Lord said, go again. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver. Amazing love. Oh, what sacrifice. The Son of God given for me. My debt He paid. My debt He paid that I might live. Doesn't matter where you are in this world and doesn't matter what you've done. God is standing there ready. He's already paid the full price. It's just a matter of you walking back into His heart and He'll take your hand and lead you. Would you pray with me? Lord, we acknowledge you as the one who's given us all good things, even when we thought they came from someone else or some job or luck or some other blasphemous idea. We've never been in the right place in the right time for any reason except for the fact that you have your hand upon us in our life. And your hand weaves a fabric in this world that expresses who we are today. And we acknowledge that to you right now in front of our brothers and sisters. We love you, Lord, but it is our prayer that we will know you more clearly and more dearly every day. You are the only one worthy of our worship, time, attention, and praise. And we give it to you in awe and adoration that you care for us as you do. Through our Savior, Jesus, we pray. Amen.